Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 24. I'm going to do the entire chapter, and we will finish up the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. This is our last chapter, 25 verses. I'm going to call it David's Census and David's Altar. Our context is this. We're in the last few chapters of 2 Samuel, wrapping up the deeds and events of David's kingdom. In our last chapter, we saw the so-called last words of David. David's mighty men were described for us. The chapter before that was actually what became a later psalm, Psalm 18. And then David gave up, in the previous chapter before that, 2 Samuel 21, David gave up seven Israelites for the Gibeonites to put to death because Saul had violated the truce with the Gibeonites that Joshua had made with the Gibeonites. So these are miscellaneous events happening at the end. We go down to 2 Samuel 24:1 and begin. Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, "Go number Israel and Judah." Now we see the word again. Here's some example of God's previous wrath against Israel. There was a three-year famine to punish Israel for the way Saul violated the treaty with the Gibeonites, as I just mentioned in chapter 21. So there was 3 years famine for that. Verse 1 of that chapter, during David's reign, there was a famine for three successive years. So David inquired of the Lord. The Lord answered, "It is because of the blood shed by Saul and his family when he killed the Gibeonites." So we're going to assume here that this again is just a second and another time of where the Lord burned against Israel. Now, in the NASB translation, which I'm using here, it's the anger of the Lord that burned against Israel. And that anger, it incited David against the Israelites to say this, "Go number Israel and Judah," to do this, to go number Israel and Judah. Well, what would God be angry at? Well, he could be angry at the census itself, that David actually carried out a census when he shouldn't have. And so that would mean the anger would spring out of God for whatever bad reason David did the census, which we'll talk about later. Or it could be that the anger of the Lord incited David and burned against Israel because that the people had rebelled. Absalom's rebellion, Sheba's rebellion that came right after that. You recall those horrible civil wars that racked the nation of Israel. It could be that those rebellions caused God to be angry at the people, and so therefore God incited, i.e. allowed, David to do the census, because doing the census would be a negative thing for the people. There would be military draft. That's why you do censuses. There would be more taxes. Well, there's some translation issues here in verse 1, so let's get with it. First of all, as just said, the NASB has the "it" incited David, and the "it," according to that translation, refers to the anger of the Lord. But now the ESV, the King James, the NIV, they all have "he," referring to the Lord, "he incited David." Well, why did this occur? Because in Hebrew there's no subject for incited. Why do the different translations occur? Because there's no subject for incited in the Hebrew. But here's some other options besides the anger of the Lord or the Lord that might have done the inciting. In other words, the NASB has the anger of the Lord incited David. The ESV, KJV, and the NIV have the Lord incited David. Well, since there's no subject for incited, because it could be translated "and one incited David," in other words, leaving the subject unclear, like a passive, and David was incited, but it doesn't say who did it. Well, it could be David's own evil imagination that incited David's anger against the people. Could have been Satan. 1 Chronicles 21:1 actually says Satan incited David. And Satan could be translated not as the chief demon Satan, but as an adversary, because that's what Satan means. And so then it could be some one of David's counselors that incited David against the people. So we have a lot of options here. The most common options are that God incited Israel in 2 Samuel 24:1 and the devil incited Israel and 1 Chronicles 21:1. So we'll start with those two options and give a reconciliation. The reconciliation is fairly easy, actually. Two possible ways to do it. Here's the first way. God is only permitting Satan to tempt David in 1 Chronicles 21:1. Satan stood up against Israel, so Satan is the main instigator, the prime mover here. And then in Samuel, 2 Samuel 24:1, the Lord incited David. How? By allowing Satan to do his thing. In other words, God allowed Satan to do what Satan wanted to do because God wanted Satan to carry out God's purposes because God is sovereign over Satan. And that's an easy reconciliation, actually. Let me read Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown on the issue. Quote, God, though he cannot tempt any man, James 1:13, is frequently described in Scripture as doing what he merely permits to be done. And so in this case, he permitted Satan to tempt David. Satan was the active mover, while God only withdrew his supporting grace. And the great tempter prevailed against the king. Matthew Henry says this, quote, we are sure that God is not the author of sin. He tempts no man. We are told, 1 Chronicles 21:1, that Satan provoked David to number Israel. Satan, as an enemy, suggested it for a sin, as he put it into the heart of Judas to betray Christ. God, as righteous judge, permitted it, with a design from this sin of David to take an occasion to punish Israel for other sins for which he might justly have punished them without this. I think that makes perfectly good sense. So we can summarize by saying that God only orchestrated the events that led up to David's sin, but he didn't cause David's sin itself. The NIV Study Bible says, quote, to incite, in this case, may have meant that God orchestrated the events that led to David's decision. In other words, God just controlled the events around David, then David made his free moral choice to go measure the census. Therefore, God is not the author of evil. David was the author of evil. It was either Satan putting the idea in David's mind, David listening to the idea of Satan that caused David to do the census, but it wasn't God, not directly. He either permitted it or he orchestrated the events around the decision of David. So David says, go number Israel and Judah. Of course, who did he say it to? He said it to Joab. We'll see in a minute. Now, when he says number all Israel, he doesn't mean every man, woman, and child. He's talking about the men capable of military activity, soldiers. And we'll see later on in this chapter, 2 Samuel 24:9, Joab gave the king the total of the registration of the troops. This is what this is. This is a, we call it a census. The English translations have census. And we hear census, we tend to think of man, every man, woman, and child, like the American census. But the Homer Christian Study Bible translation in 2 Samuel 24:9 says it was a registration of the troops. There were 800,000 fighting men from Israel and 500,000 men from Judah. Notice that proportionally more soldiers came from Judah than anywhere else in the kingdom. That shows the prominence, the preeminence, and the prominence of the tribe of Judah. Now we ask a philosophical question here. Why would this seemingly innocuous census cause God to be so angry? We're going to see later that 70,000 people are killed because of this census by God. This was no light matter. Why was God so angry? Especially since Moses had twice numbered the people without committing a crime. You remember in the book of Numbers, there were two censuses. And David's a military leader. Shouldn't a military leader know how many men are in his military? What's wrong with this? Well, you could argue that way, but you won't get very far because David himself knew that the census was a sin. We see later in verse 10 in this chapter, David's conscience troubled him after he had taken a census of the troops. He said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I've done. Now, Lord, because I've been very foolish, take away your servant's guilt. So he mentions a troubled conscience. He's mentioned sinning greatly. He's mentioned his guilt and his foolishness all in one verse. So he knew it was guilty. He knew the census. He knew he was guilty for taking a census. Now, let's look at some suggestions as to why the census was a sin. Now, some of these are off the wall. I'm going to give you what I think is the real reason here. But let's look at some suggestions. David carried out the census improperly because he didn't number those under 20. That's option number one. I don't know which commentator gave me this idea, but the idea is the census is illegal for some reason that I don't know, that I don't understand, but not numbering those under 20 would make the census illegal, and therefore God got mad. To kill 70,000 people, I don't think so. I think that's too. We do know that David didn't count men under age 20, 1 Chronicles 27:23. David didn't count the men age 20 or under, and so we're going to say God's angry because of that. That's not it. Option number two as to why God was so angry. David did not require those being numbered to pay the half-shekel temple tax. Now, the temple tax was required by law as a ransom for the Israelites' souls. We see this in Exodus 30:12. When you take a census of the Israelites to register them, each of the men must pay a ransom for himself to the Lord as they are registered. Then no plague will come on them as they are registered. So the idea is, well, David took a census just like Moses did. He's supposed to do that, but the law here says that not only were the names to be written down, but a half shekel tax was to be taken from them, and if it wasn't, a plague would come on them. That's in the law, Exodus 30:12. That's exactly what happened here. David took the census and a plague came on them. So people reasoned that perhaps that's why God was so angry. David didn't ransom the people with the half shekel tax. Here's the third possible reason God got so angry. David took the census in order to raise taxes on all Israel. The taxes would then go into David's royal treasury. And God didn't want David to get rich like that by fleecing the people. Well, there's some arguments against that idea. The scriptures nowhere state this. This is just speculation. Matthew Henry says, quote, "Nor was David ever a raiser of taxes." Well, but you can speculate that David did take that census to raise taxes because governments always want to raise taxes on their subjects. That's all they think about, is how to get more money out of their long-suffering citizens. So it wouldn't surprise me if David had the same idea. But that's option number three. God didn't want taxes to be raised. Option number four, David took the census on his own motion with no direction from God, thus needlessly troubling the people. In other words, he just didn't pray about it before he did it. Really? 70,000 people killed? I don't think that's the right answer to why God was so angry. Option number five, David affronted the ancient promise to Abraham that Abraham's seed would be innumerable as dust. He contradicted that ancient promise. The census showed that David distrusted the promise. It showed that David worried about whether the promise to Abraham had been fulfilled. In fact, maybe David was going so far as to prove the promise to Abraham was wrong, although I don't doubt he would do that. But Abraham said that the descendants of Abraham could not be numbered, and David's trying to number them. He's trying to number the innumerable. Well, you could say the same thing about Moses in the book of Numbers. He was trying to number the innumerable. I don't think that's a reasonable suggestion as to why God was so angry. Here's number six, is the reason I think that God was so angry with David, because David was proud in his heart. David wanted to show his greatness in being the leader of such a large host. He would publish the results to all the nations and say, "Look how many people I've got in my army." And he would trust in his military strength, not in God. Recall King Hezekiah later on showed his treasures to the Babylonian ambassadors. That came back to haunt him because the Babylonians came back looking for that treasure. All right, so option number six, David's proud, takes a census trying to show how big his army was. God didn't like that. Option number seven, David was taking a census so that he could take his army and go conquer some surrounding nations. That, again, is a speculation. I don't know how you can prove one way or another how or why he did that. I think the answer is number six here. David was proud. God doesn't like proud people. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verses 2 through 4. The king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and register the people, that I may know the number of the people." But Joab said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. The Holman Christian Study Bible has "to register the troops of Israel." People is a pretty weak translation, in my humble opinion. David wants this census to be from Dan to Beersheba. Dan was the extreme north, north of Lake Hula, which is north of the Sea of Galilee, at the northern extremity of Israel near Caesarea Philippi, as it was called back during the time of Jesus. Beersheba is at the extreme south of Israel, about 35 miles southwest of Hebron in the desert down there. Bethlehem is about 6 miles south of Jerusalem, so we're talking about over 40 miles southwest of Jerusalem that Beersheba is. So that's the extremes. Now, Joab is going to kick against this command to number the troops. He says, "Well, you know, I hope you get up with a lot of people while you can still see all the troops that you're going to have. I hope you have a lot of troops. But why do you want them? Why do you delight in this thing?" We may speculate that Joab's tone of voice was modest and polite, as Gill and Henry suggest. John Gill says, quote, not so rudely and insolently as he did on account of his mourning for Absalom, but in a more modest, decent, and polite manner. On David's mourning for Absalom, if you recall when David cried so much because Absalom had been beat, Joab went to David and said, you're acting like a fool, and he was very, very sharp with him. But here he's very humble. Now, why would Joab be opposed to the census? Well, there's two possible reasons that I can see. The first possible option is that Joab knew that God was opposed to this option, and so Joab wanted to do God's will. There's a problem with that, though, is why would the murderer of Abner, Amasa, and Uriah, three times already Joab's murdered people, I don't mean killed them in combat, I mean murdered them, why would a murderer like Joab care what God thinks? Well, I saw someone on the internet try to defend Joab, stating that Joab, although morally flawed, he still believed in God. In 2 Samuel 2:27, he said, as God lives. In other words, Joab took an oath. Everybody was taking that oath, as God lives. It's like people saying today, oh my God, it doesn't really mean that much. So I don't think that proves that Joab is a godly person. Now also, when Joab and Abishai were jointly carrying on operations against the Ammonites, this was after Uriah had been killed, they were at Rabbah, capital city of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites were allied with the Syrians, the Arameans. And so Joab said, look, if the Ammonites are too strong for you, Abishai, my brother, I'll come to help you. We must prove ourselves strong for our people and for the cities of our God. May the Lord's will be done. But I can see somebody just hardened, just talking God talk, because that's the way each culture talks. But I just cannot believe that Joab, although a lot of times he gave good advice, like the advice with Absalom, when Absalom died and David's crying too much, that was good advice. He was a smart guy, although he was morally reprehensible and David hated his guts. Well, if the reason that Joab opposed the census was not for spiritual reasons, the other option is that he was concerned for the natural consequences that might follow from taking the census. As Benson, Poole, and Colin Delitzsch say, the people were going to be inconvenienced and burdened by a census. A census means that people are going to be militarily drafted to get their heads beat in an arm in a battle, or a census is being taken so that they may be taxed more easily. And of course, people don't like taxes, and they don't like to be drafted into the military. As the pulpit commentary says, the census would be fatal to the liberties of Israel. And so Joab could see where David was heading. When David wanted a census, David had already ordered Joab to kill Uriah, and Joab probably despised David for asking him to kill one of his top commanders. He knew that David was turning into a tyrant, and so he's saying, this is just one more example of David trying to aggrandize power for himself, and there's not going to be any good outcome from that. But David doesn't listen. In verse 4, we read, nevertheless, the king's word, David's word, prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. It was not just Joab who's seeing what's going to happen from this census, but also the military leaders besides Joab, under Joab. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verse 5. They crossed the Jordan, that's the army commanders. They crossed the Jordan, camped in Aroer, that's A-R-O-E-R, Aroer, south of the town in the middle of the valley, and then proceeded toward Gat and Jazer. Now, Aroer is on the Arnon River, which bisects the Dead Sea, running from east to west, halfway down the coast there. South of the Aroer Valley is Moab. North of the Aroer Valley is the Trans-Jordan Israeli tribe of Reuben. And Reuben runs straight up the coast of the Dead Sea, that area all the way up to the tip-top northern top of the Dead Sea. You go another 10 miles or so and you get Jazer, which is in the territory of Gad. So we see these surveyors or these census takers go from the far south on the east from Aroer straight up through Reuben. They finished counting how many Reubenite soldiers there are. Then they go up to Jazer in the middle of Gad and count Gad. Two tribes done. Aroer is described as, or the camp of the commanders, the census takers, is said to be south of Aroer in the middle of the valley. Incidental detail, if you look at the map, the Aroer Valley is runs through those mountains, steep mountains that are there. It's a ridge of mountains. And so south of the city is going toward the river, and that's where the commander slept. We go to verse 6. They went to Gilead into the land of the Hittites and continued on to Danjan and around to Sidon. Gilead is easy. Just go to the east of the Jordan River, go from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea, and you extend yourself about 10 or, I don't know, maybe let's say 10 miles to the east of the Jordan River. That long strip of land is called Gilead. Also, the area around there to the east is called Gilead. It's a lot of times it's sort of loose. So now we're going up from up from Jazer, which is in Gilead, basically. It's in the tribe of Gad, right to the east of Gilead proper. And you keep going, you cross the Jabbok, keep going, you get to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee, keep going north of the Sea of Galilee, the north of Lake Hula, take a west, and you go to the land of the Hittites. That is probably the Hittites of Kadesh, which was the Hittite capital, on the Orontes River, which is in present-day Lebanon. Kadesh is a famous battle, ancient battle there between, never mind, it's just an ancient, the Egyptians got involved in a battle there a long time ago. It's a famous place. So we'll assume that that's what we're talking about, the land of the Kittites there in Lebanon, almost, in the Anti-Lebanon Range. They continued on to Danjan. That's how I'm pronouncing it. Danjan means woodland Dan, near the sources of the Jordan. That, again, is near Caesarea Philippi, up around that area, north of Lake Hula. Keep going west, and you end up on the coast. Actually, go northwest to end up at Sidon on the Mediterranean coast. And then they're going to go south from there to Tyre, which is south on the Mediterranean coast. I don't know, about 30 miles or so. We go to verse 7, 2 Samuel 24. And the commanders came to the stronghold of Tyre, the census takers. Tyre, like I said, is about 30 miles south of Sidon on the Mediterranean coast, the famous city of Tyre. That would be the old city, not the new city that's connected to the old city by an embankment, if you will, a ramp. To all the cities of the Hivites, that means the Hivites. Let me read you something about the Hivites from Easton's dictionary. The Hivites were one of the original tribes scattered over Palestine from Hermon to Gibeon in the south. So they're scattered. They principally inhabited the northern confines of western Palestine. In other words, right south of Lebanon, northern part of Israel on the Mediterranean Sea. So the commanders counted all those people up in that tribe. That would be the tribe of Asher. And of the Canaanites here is probably the specific word for Canaanites, meaning the towns and people of present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia, as it was called back then. Then the census takers went out to the south of Judah, even to Beersheba, as I said, far to the south. There's a road that runs from Beersheba going northeast. It's called the Central Ridge Road. It goes right into Hebron, after about 20 miles or so. And then that same Central Ridge Road runs up from Hebron to Bethlehem, and then from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verses 8 through 9. So when they, these are the census takers, had gone about through the whole land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. And Joab gave the number of the registration of the troops to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah with 500,000 men. Now 9 months and 20 days, that's a considerably long time, and yet the work was still not finished. We look at our parallel passages in 1 Chronicles, chapter 21, verse 6. But he, referring to Joab, did not include Levi and Benjamin in the count because the king's command was detestable to him. We see here that Joab really thought David's idea of a census was stupid. And, you know, when you tell somebody to do something and there's not buy-in, they don't do a good job. And Joab left out Levi and Benjamin. 1 Chronicles 27:24 says this, Joab, son of Zeruiah, that's David's sister, began to count them, but he didn't complete it. There was wrath against Israel because of this census, and the number was not entered in the historical record of King David. Now, in verse 9, we see that the number of soldiers that were registered to Israel, that's the northern 10 tribes, 800,000. The number that were registered to Judah were 500,000. Well, let's take Israel's 800,000 first. We have a reconciliation issue because in 1 Chronicles, Israel is said to have 1,100,000 troops. That is 300,000 more in 1 Chronicles than we have here in 2 Samuel. Now, how do we handle the extra 300,000 that are located in 1 Chronicles 21? John Gill's got a way. I don't think it's good, but he says that the extra 300,000 in 1 Chronicles 21 is the officers who were not included in the number in 2 Samuel. So it would be 800,000 soldiers and 300,000 officers. That's possible, but I like this reconciliation better. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. I will quote from him directly. The amount here stated, compared with 1 Chronicles 21 verse 5, gives a difference of 300,000. The discrepancy is only apparent and admits of an easy reconciliation. Thus, there were 12 divisions of general. If you read 1 Chronicles 27 verses 1 through 15, you'll see these 12 divisions of generals who commanded monthly and whose duty was to keep guard on the royal person, each having a body of troops consisting of 24,000 men, which together formed an army of 288,000. So there's 288,000 of the 300,000 that are missing, present in 1 Chronicles 25, but not present in 1 Chronicles 27, but not present in 2 Samuel 24. Now, what do we do with the next 12,000 soldiers that are? We're still short 12,000 to make up the 300,000 difference. Well, this is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate. They say that there was a separate detachment of 12,000 troops, one for each tribe, 1,000 for each tribe. These troops were attendant on the 12 princes of the 12 tribes mentioned in the same chapter. So both the troops guarding David and the troops guarding the leaders of the 12 tribes, you add them together and you get 300,000. Now, if you go to 1 Chronicles 27, you do see the 12 leaders of the tribe listed, but they don't have a number of troops by each of those tribal leaders, so that's an assumption. The 24,000 for each general guarding David, those 24,000 are mentioned. So 288,000 are mentioned, 12,000 are speculated. You add them together, you get 300,000 troops that are not mentioned as ordinary soldiers, as the 800,000 ordinary soldiers were mentioned in 2 Samuel 24. There's another way you can take care of the 300,000 that you're mentioning, is just to say that you got 288,000 that are mentioned extra in 1 Chronicles 27, guarding David once a month, and their officers were 12,000, not troops for each tribe, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said, but the other 12,000 are officers that govern the 288,000. So you add those together, and you got 300,000 extra men guarding David, and that's where your total of 1.1 million comes from. There's another reconciliation problem in 2 Samuel 24, verse 9. It says the men of Judah were numbered at 500,000 men, but in 1 Chronicles 21, you only have 470,000 men. So now the problem is reversed. Instead of having more soldiers for the Judahites, you've got less soldiers for the rest of Israel, 30,000. 470,000 mentioned in 1 Chronicles 21, 2 Samuel 24, there's 500,000. How do you reconcile? Well, you could say 500,000 is just a round number for 470,000. But I think Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown have a better reconciliation. Let me quote from them. Quote, exclusive of the troops before mentioned, there was an army of observation on the frontiers of the Philistines' country, composed of 30,000 men, as appears from 2 Samuel 6:1. Let me read 2 Samuel 6:1. David again assembled all the choice men in Israel, 30,000. These are the 30,000 men, of course, that carried the ark from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continues. He says, on the frontiers of the Philistine country, this troop composed of 30,000 men, which it seems were included in the number of 500,000 of the people of Judah by the author of Samuel. But the author of Chronicles, who mentions only 470,000, gives the number of that tribe exclusive of those 30,000 men. I think that's the best way to reconcile it. John Gill goes another way, which I don't think is a good way to reconcile. He says a plague wiped out 30,000 men before the chronicler recorded the amount. He says, quote, there were so many in the sum total of the men of Judah before the plague, 400,000 or 500,000, but 30,000 being consumed by the plague are left out in the latter accounts, which drops you down to 470,000. I find that extremely difficult to believe. I guess it could be there were 70,000 people that died in the plague because of the census problems, the punishment to David because of the census, and I guess you could say 30,000 of them were soldiers. I guess that's possible. But I like Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's reconciliation the best. Well, whatever the number was, and however it was calculated, was David happy with the amount? Did the total number mortify his pride, or rather feed it? In other words, does he think, oh, I don't have very many troops there? As a matter of fact, we'll look at these numbers later. There were less troops under David than there were when Israel left Egypt. So the people had not increased in Canaan as they had in Egypt. So maybe the sum hurt his pride, or maybe the sum fed it. He's saying, well, I'm doing pretty good. We don't know, but we do know the people had not increased in Canaan as they had in Egypt, despite the fact that Canaan was a very fruitful land, a land of milk and honey. This is Matthew Henry's observation. And my observation is this. This is a sad commentary on the people of God. In the land of prosperity, in the land of milk and honey, they decreased. But in the land of tribulation, the land of slavery, Egypt, they increased. Think about that for an application to today's Christian church. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verse 10. Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly. Why is David's conscience now troubling him? His conscience hadn't been bothered now for 9 months and 20 days, and all of a sudden, he's pricked in his soul. Why? What made him wake up to his moral obligations now? Well, I don't know. We can't tell. Sometimes people just have an attack of conscience. Matthew Henry says this, quote, when the account was finished and laid before him, that means the number of troops were given before him, that very night his conscience was awakened, and he felt the pain of it just then when he promised himself the pleasure of it. When he was about to feast on the satisfaction of the number of his people, it was turned into the gall of asps within him. An asp is a poisonous snake, and the gall is the poison of the poisonous snake. And Matthew Henry thinks that David was happy with the numbers, but then his conscience hit him and he was no longer happy. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verses 11 through 13. When David got up in the morning, a revelation from the Lord had come to the prophet Gad, David's seer. Go and say to David, this is what the Lord says. I am offering you three choices. Choose one of them, and I will do it to you. So Gad went to David, told him the choices, and asked him, do you want 3 years of famine to come on your land? To flee from your foes 3 months while they pursue you? Or to have a plague in your land 3 days? Now think it over and decide what answer I should take back to the one who sent me. Of course, the one who sent Gad was Yahweh, God. It was probably in the morning. Well, it was in the morning. It was probably very early in the morning because David wasn't sleeping because of his guilty conscience. Gad shows up, and of course, it would have been wiser for David to ask the will of God, maybe ask for a prophecy from Gad before he took the census, but he was bullheaded. He just went ahead in his flesh without asking God and did it anyway. It's better to get a word of God before you take a big action rather than afterwards because you're likely to make a mistake in your flesh. And David did that. So Gad says, choose. Now, this was merciful on God's part because God could have just punished David however God wanted to, but he gave David a choice. Now, the fact that this was the very first thing Gad said when he saw David shows that David himself was aware of his sin. Gad didn't need to convince him of it. It was very obvious. David was conscience-stricken, so Gad didn't go into that. He says, okay, you sin. Now, let's see what God's going to do about it. It wasn't a prophetic urging that caused David to repent, apparently. The Adam Clark disagrees with that. He says it is supposed that David's contrition arose from the reproof given by Gad, and that the order of time the reproof came, that in the order of time the reproof came before the confession stated in the 10th verse. I don't think so. I think David just had his conscience awoken, and he confessed, and then Gad showed up. We could debate on that. It's not of all that importance. The point is David is contrite, and now he's got to face the music. Now we have a textual problem here. This chapter's full of them. Gad asked David, do you want 3 years of famine? That's the Holman Christian Study Bible. 3 years of famine. The Masoretic text, the Hebrew text, have 7 years. The NASB translates it as 7 years. Do you want 7 years of famine? Well, how do we reconcile this discrepancy? 7 years in the NASB and 3 years in Holman Christian Study Bible. Well, first, let's point out that the seven, it comes from the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text, NASB, Young's Little Translation, KJV, the American Standard Version, God's Word Version, Darby, they all translated as 7 years using the Masoretic text. The Septuagint has 3 years, and the Holman Christian Study Bible and the New American Bible, for example, translated as 3 years. Well, 3 years, of course, is the easiest for us because we have in 1 Chronicles 21:12, 3 years as option number one presented by Gad to David, either 3 years of famine, not seven. Well, if you take the Septuagint version, there's no reconciliation problem at all. But let's say you don't. How do you reconcile seven with three? Well, here's option number one. Take the 3 years of famine that occurred because of Saul's sin by attacking the Gibeonites, violating Joshua's treaty with the Gibeonites. We just read about that in 2 Samuel 21 just recently. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year, and David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. Well, there's 3 years of famine. Let's assume that the year that David was talking about, rain had not fallen yet in that year, that's 4 years. And then Gad prophesies 3 more years for a total of 7. So in 1 Chronicles 21:12, it's the 3 extra years that Gad prophesies. In Samuel, it would be the 4 years that are added to that, 3 years of Saul's famine and 1 year of the counting the year that David is talking in. Well, that's very clever. I don't believe it. I think that's too clever by half. The easiest answer is it's a copyist error in the Masoretic text. John Gill and Adam Clark point out, for example, in writing the Hebrew number for seven, well, I guess it's a word, the Hebrew character for seven and the Hebrew character for three, if you look at it, I'm looking at them on my screen now, they look almost exactly alike. It would be very easy for a copyist to make a mistake there. All right, so we're going to assume option number one that Gad gave Dave is you got 3 years of famine to come. Now, notice how these choices work. It goes from years to months to days. You got 3 years of famine, or 3 months that you are being pursued by your enemies, or 3 days that you have a plague. Well, as I was reading this, I'd forgotten what David had chosen. I said, what would I do in that situation? I choose the shortest. It's a bad choice, but I would choose the shortest time. And that's exactly what David did. Let's think about option number two. Your enemies will chase you. You think, well, that might not be so bad, getting chased for 3 months. Well, your soldiers, there'd be a prodigious amount of them killed because they're on the defensive, in retreat. The land would be devastated, and there would be great shame and disgrace. Who knows what further bad things might happen if you show weakness at this time of defeat. The plague, option number three that David could choose from, is called the Sword of the Lord in Chronicles. We often think of the Sword of the Lord, of course, as the Bible, but here the Sword of the Lord is a pestilence. 1 Chronicles 21:12, Gad is speaking, either 3 years of famine or 3 months to be swept away before your foes while the sword of your enemies overtakes you, or else 3 days of the Sword of the Lord, even pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout the territory of Israel. Now, this phrase, Sword of the Lord, emphasizes the direct action of God. Option number two, your enemies pursue you, David. That's the sword of man, but this is the sword of God, the plague would be. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verses 14 and 15. Then David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great. But do not let me fall into the hand of man. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. Now David says in 14 to Gad, I am in great distress. Well, I guess he is. That was a hard choice he had to make. But he decided to fall into the hand of the Lord, maybe thinking that maybe God would have mercy on him, but he knew if he fell in the hand of a opposing enemy army, they would execute him and destroy his kingdom. So man is more directly involved in that choice. The flee choice, the pursuit choice, as opposed to the sword of the Lord and the plague choice. Now, the other choice was 3 years of famine, and that would not be directly from the Lord. Well, I guess it would be. I mean, insurance companies call it the act of God, and a man would not be causing the famine, so I guess he didn't want to fall into the hand of man. Option number two, to flee from his enemies. So he had to choose between 3-year famine. That's a long time. A lot of people going to die. Or just get it over with in a hurry. 3 days of plague. I think it makes sense that he chose 3 days of plague. Now, another reason why David didn't choose to be pursued by his enemies for 3 months was he would have to buy food from other nations. He would be defeated in a war. And he also might be accused of self-interest if he took that option, because kings can run. They can find asylum, whereas the ordinary person could not. But if there's a plague coming, David just as subject to a plague as everybody else is. A plague, the virus or whatever it is that causes the plague, cannot discriminate against blue blood and ordinary blood, against big shots and small fry. But if he was fleeing from an enemy, he could flee from a fortified city to another fortified city. And in fact, the Israelites had already said they didn't want David fighting out in front of the army anymore. 2 Samuel 21:17. When David got himself in trouble fighting a Philistine, and Abishai had to rescue him, then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel." So David could have gotten by with an attack from foreigners, but it would have looked bad. But if he subjects himself to the plague, just like all of his other citizens, it doesn't look so bad. And then option number one, a 3-year famine, well, who's going to be able to store up more food than anybody else? That would be the king. He would survive it. But boy, when he puts himself under a plague, he might die just like everybody else might die. So I think that's why David chose the plague. First of all, it was the shortest option. It was over quickly. And also, he could not be accused of self-interest by choosing the plague option. Now, the very next morning, verse 15, that would be the morning that Gad, it should have, remember, David was up early in the morning, Gad came. So that from that morning, for 3 days, and again, that's not necessarily 24 hours a day in Israel. Israelite reckoning was a part of a day counts as a day. So some part of 3 days, the plague fell, 70,000 men died. Well, this is interesting. David was trying to see how many people he had in the census. Well, he's got 70,000 less now. This was a fitting punishment for David's pride. He was seeking for glory through a large population. Many people speculate, and I do too. Now his population has shrunk. And 70,000, that's a lot of people dying for just 3 days, as Adam Clark says. Now, we come to the ethical problem. Did the punishment fit the crime? The NIV Study Bible suggests this, saying the punishment seems to be too severe. It does seem pretty severe. Well, here's a couple of observations that the NIV Study Bible makes that might mitigate that charge of harshness against Yahweh. First of all, the people may have been punished in addition to David for participating in Absalom's rebellion and Sheba's rebellion. I've already mentioned that in the first part of this audio. And so, not just David being punished, the people being punished. The people had a rebellion. David feels insecure. He needs to take a census to make him feel more secure. He doesn't rely on God. He's kind of wandering away from God at this point. And so, God works it out so that the people are punished as well as David, 70,000 of them. Well, okay, that might be true, but some of those 70,000 must have stayed loyal to David, and they were innocent in the rebellion, and yet they get killed in the plague. Well, let's stick with the guilt. Let's assume that there's guilty ones in that 70,000. Let's keep assuming that just for the minute here. And let's note that God was angry with Israel before he, through Satan, incited David to number. First verse of this chapter. God was angry before. Using the NASB translation, 2 Samuel 24:1. Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them. So again the anger of the Lord burned. So the anger of the Lord had already burned against Israel. It doesn't say how, but we can assume that rebellion didn't make God too happy. All right, but even so, we probably should assume that some of those 70,000 people were innocent. And how do we account for that? Well, the sad thing is, innocent people often suffer for what their leaders do. In fact, they always do. To give you a minor example, the people of America are suffering because of the moronic economic decisions of the leadership of America. 7% inflation, 7.5% inflation right now, 9% wholesale level. Nobody in America did that. Not directly, anyway. They voted for fools who decide they can just make money by printing as much of it as they want, and now we're all suffering. I didn't vote for those fools, but I'm suffering. So, today, as well as all the way back in human history, people have suffered for what their leaders do. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says. Because of our Western individualism, we struggle to understand the Eastern tradition in which the head of a family, tribe, or nation represented the people under them. The members were treated as a whole, sharing in the blessings of punishment resulting from the actions of their leaders. When Achan sinned, God said, Israel has sinned. Israel has sinned, not just Achan. Joshua had to identify the tribe, clan, and family to which the sinner belonged. That's the way they thought back then. But I would submit to you, there's a lot of that going on even today. How about Adam's sin, and we all suffer? I didn't do what Adam did. Well, not originally. Of course, I have walked in Adam's footsteps, as is every other human being on earth. So we can't say that we're not guilty of sin. But nonetheless, we suffered for what Adam did. And likewise, we also blessed a lot of times by what our leaders do. I've been blessed by a lot of great things living in America because of what certain American leaders have chosen to do in the past. Liberal democracy, rule of law, free market economics. And I'm sitting pretty, but I didn't have anything to do with that. So, yeah, 70,000 people died. We don't know about their eternal state either. They could very well have been believers and followers of Yahweh. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, verse 16. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who destroyed the people, "It is enough. Now relax your hand." And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So the 3 days are up. Jerusalem's about to go down to the plague. God said, "Nope, hold off. Let's let Jerusalem alone." Perhaps Jerusalem was the last place where the people were numbered, so it would be appropriate that the last place where the plague appeared would be Jerusalem. It would show that the punishment had directly to do with the census. In other words, the plague would follow the same track as the census takers did, moving around the country, then starting in Jerusalem, and then ending in Jerusalem. Perhaps that's pretty speculative. But at any rate, Jerusalem is saved. Now I've got a question here. The Lord, that's Yahweh, says to the angel who was destroying the people, "Stop. That's enough." How did the author of 2 Samuel know what God said to the angel? This is an inter-triune conversation, inter-trinity conversation. Well, whoever wrote 2 Samuel, some people say Gad, some people say Nathan, some people say Samuel up to a certain point. Whoever wrote it, maybe they had a prophetic revelation. If you believe in the inspiration of scriptures as I do, if you believe in prophecy like I do, that's not a problem. Could be that there was an audible voice spoken to the angel from heaven. "Stop, it is enough," and everybody heard it. At any rate, the angel stopped. Now, this angel is called the angel of the Lord in this verse, and usually the angel of the Lord is Jesus. And I was just thinking it was Jesus. It's interesting, though I looked at almost all of my commentators, 5 or 6, 7 of them, and they all said it was just an ordinary angel. So we'll take that as an ordinary angel who's destroying, carrying out judgment on Jerusalem. Now we have a little problem here. Why does David build an altar if he already knows that the plague has been stopped? The plague has been stopped in verse 16. He builds the altar later in verse next couple of verses here later on. Well, there's a couple of ways you can handle that. One way is that the altar was not an altar that was built in order to stop the plague, but rather it was an altar built to offer sacrifices to thank God for stopping the plague. An altar of thanksgiving, if you will, rather than an altar for intercession. So if it's an altar for thanksgiving, then we can just take the chronological order like we have it in the verse. The plague stops here in our verse that we're on now, verse 16, and then the altar is built later on in starting in verse 18. That's the easiest way to take it. John Gill takes it that way. He says this, "For though David had acknowledged his sin and God had repented of the evil he inflicted for it and given orders for stopping it, yet he would have an altar built and sacrifices offered to show that the only way to have peace and pardon and safety from ruin and destruction deserved by sin is through the expiatory sacrifice of Christ, of which sacrifices were typical and were designed to lead the faith of the Lord's people to that." So Gill says, yeah, he was putting an altar on there to give thanks to God. But another way you can say it is that the chronology is reversed, that verse 16 is stated in anticipation of what happened later. In other words, verse 16 about the stopping of the plague didn't happen until after the altar was built later on. Jameson Foster Brown holds this view. It is evident that the plague was not stayed till after the altar was built and the sacrifice offered. So that what is related in 2 Samuel 24, verse 16, that's the verse we're on now, was by anticipation. Previous to the offering of the sacrifice, David had seen the destroying angel as well as offered the intercessory prayer, which we see later on in verse 17. Later on. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that the altar was built first, and it was built in order that the plague would be stopped. Now, a verse that would back that up is 2 Samuel 24:21. Araunah, that's the owner of the threshing floors, said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" David replied, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, so the plague on the people may be halted." Well, doesn't that prove, verse 21, that the purpose of building the altar was to stop the plague, not to give thanksgiving for the plague already having been stopped? Therefore, verse 16 about the plague having been stopped must be out of time order and spoken in anticipation of when that altar was built later in verse 21. Well, it would seem that way, but that depends on the translation. If you go to the Young's literal translation and read 2 Samuel 24:21, "And Araunah said, Wherefore hath my lord the king come unto his servant? And David saith, To buy from thee the threshing floor, to build an altar to Jehovah, and the plague is restrained from the people." And the plague is restrained from the people is not saying, so the plague may be restrained from the people. So the Hebrew is obviously ambiguous enough to where this could be an altar for thanksgiving put up after the plague had stopped in verse 16, the altar of thanksgiving having been put up in verse 21, and the plague having been restrained from the people at verse 21. One fact that makes me pretty sure that that altar was an altar of thanksgiving and not an altar of intercession, that the plague stopped before the altar was built, is that the time for the plague was set at 3 days. So what's the point of putting an altar up to stop the plague if you know that Yahweh is going to stop the plague after 3 days, because that's what he said he was going to do? Now, as I said, this angel of the Lord that stopped the plague, most of my commentaries assume it's an ordinary angel, we read in the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 21:16-20, verse 16, "Then David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven, with his drawn sword in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem." Now, that drawn sword is an extra detail we don't get in 2 Samuel, where we are now in chapter 24. "Then David and the elders, covered with sackcloth, fell on their faces." That drawn sword was designed to inflict terror on David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, which it did. We drop down now to 1 Chronicles 21:20. Now Ornan is the same as Araunah, a different name. It's the same person with a different name. "Now Ornan turned back and saw the angel, and his four sons who were with him hid themselves, and Ornan was threshing wheat." So it scared them too, Ornan and his four sons, and they headed for cover. Now the angel said, "That's enough, stop the plague." Jerusalem was going to be the place where the temple would be established, and God did not want Jerusalem destroyed. In fact, the temple was to eventually be built right on the site of Araunah's threshing floor, which was on Mount Moriah. We read that in 2 Chronicles 3:1. "Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite." So God stops the curse and then puts a temple there. There might be something theologically significant there. Notice in 2 Chronicles 3:1, Mount Moriah is said to be the place where the Lord had appeared to his father David. Not the angel of the Lord, but just the Lord. That might lend to an argument that the angel of the Lord and the Lord are the same person, so that it would be Jesus appearing there, even though all my commentators didn't think so. So this is just my idea. We go to 2 Samuel 24:17. "When David saw the angel striking the people, he said to the Lord, Look, I am the one who sinned. I am the one who has done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and my father's family." Now David saw the angel striking the people. I guess he saw the angel with a sword upraised and about to come down on the people. I think he saw that rather than people dying from the pestilence. But at any rate, he was frightened, and he was also very charitable by saying, "Look, I'm the one who sinned." Yeah, he sinned by trying to get a census, but we've already made the case that the people may have sinned too because of Absalom's and Sheba's rebellion. A good case could be made that they had sinned, but David was very nice to take it all on himself. And it was indeed ironic that the chief sinner survived, that's David, while the people were dying. The NIV Study Bible makes an observation here. The people could have been worse off if David had died. political turmoil, civil war, and foreign invasion. Whew, that's worse than a plague, a three-day plague. So that might be David, again, is being pretty modest. He might not be thinking straight right now, but if he thought about it, he might have thought, well, you know, it might be better for me to stay alive for the sake of these sheep that I'm worried about. We go now to 2 Samuel 24, 18 through 20. So Gad came to David that day and said to him, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded. Araunah looked down and saw the king and his servants crossing over toward him. And Araunah went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. Now Gad came to David, but he was first directed to go to David by the angel of the Lord. We discover that in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 18. Then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and build an altar. So these are instructions from on high. Why does David need to build an altar on the threshing floor there? Because it's too far to go to the tabernacle, which is now at Gibeon, about 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem. This is a time of extremity here. Necessity, we're not going to worry about the legal niceties too much. Even though there was a bronze altar there they could have offered sacrifices on, that's a long way away. So the altar was built on a threshing floor. What's any significance in that? Well, there was a change of focus from the old to the new. Before, the focus was on military power, the census. Well, that military power was judged on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. What I mean by that is that the angel of the Lord was standing there on that threshing floor with his sword saying, you can forget about this census of military power. Now we're going to focus on worshiping God, because this is where the temple's going to be. Now, of course, they didn't know that at this time, but there was an altar there, and that was sort of the down payment for the temple that's later going to be built in the time of Solomon. So now we're not talking about military power. We're talking about altars. We're talking about God now. So in verse 20, Araunah looked down and saw the king and his servants. Looked down from his hiding place where he had hid himself, wherever that was. We know that he hid from 1 Chronicles 21:20. Now Ornan turned back and saw the angel and his four sons who were with him hid themselves. And Ornan was threshing wheat. Perhaps he had hid himself among the sheaves of wheat that were stacked up for threshing. And that's why it says he came down out of the wheat, and he saw David coming. We go now to chapter 24, verses 21 through 25 of 2 Samuel. Then Araunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? Now, this is a logical question. One does not often see a king walking across your threshing floor. And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back from the people. Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. Everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. However, the king said to Araunah, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Now this Araunah was a good man, as Adam Clark says. He was loyal to the king. He was willing to give up everything he had to stay the plague. He said in verse 23, everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king. He's given him everything. The oxen, those are valuable for a farmer. Oxen, it's valuable. The sledges. Those sledges were wooden sledges filled with rocks, and they put iron teeth on the bottom of the sledge. The rocks would give it weight, so when they pulled it, the stones would push the iron teeth into the unthreshed wheat in order to thresh it. And the sledges were dragged by the oxen over sheaves of corn, and that was his livelihood. And he says, I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you, David. Pretty nice guy. But David says, I'm not going to take you up on the offer, Araunah, because I'm not going to give a sacrifice that doesn't cost me anything. Sacrifice is supposed to be a sacrifice, and that's not a sacrifice for me if you give it to me. So he says, I will buy it for a price, it says in verse 24, 2 Samuel 24. We have a little detail from 1 Chronicles 21:24. Everything is 24 here. 1 Chronicles 21:24. But King David said to Ornan, no, but, and remember, Ornan is Araunah. Remember, Ornan is Araunah, the same person. No, but I will surely buy it for the full price. for I will not take what is yours for the Lord, or offer a burnt offering which cost me nothing. So if David had not paid for the sacrifice, it would be Araunah's sacrifice, not David's. He pays, in verse 24, 50 shekels of silver. Home of Christian Study Bible converts it to English units at 20 ounces of silver. Another reconciliation problem here in Chronicles, it's 600 gold shekels that are paid. We read in 1 Chronicles 21, 25, so David gave Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the site. Well, how do we reconcile? Well, if you take the Septuagint reading, the Septuagint has 50 shekels of silver, the Masoretic text has 50 shekels of silver, and everything's copacetic. Now, of course, you always wondered, well, did the Septuagint translators do something to make it match? Well, if you don't like that way to reconcile it, you can reconcile it this way. There were two purchases. This is from Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown. The first purchase was of the threshing floor, the small area of land where the wheat was threshed, the oxen and the instruments, the sledge and the oxen that were used for the threshing. That was the first purchase at 50 shekels of silver. And then the second purchase was the large space of ground on which the temple was later built. Reading 1 Chronicles 21:25 again, so David gave Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the site. In other words, not for the threshing floor, not for the oxen, not for the instruments. Now, in verse 25, David builds the altar, offers some burnt offerings and peace offerings. Those are the two types of offerings that are often offered. And the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Again, that sounds like it was because of the sacrifice that the plague was held back. That's not necessarily so. It could be just a summary statement that God was moved, and he moved the plague back from Israel, but not necessarily because of the offering. I mean, after all, the penalty was for 3 days. So I don't know why there has to be an offering to stop the plague if the plague has already been fixed by God at 3 days. Whether you offer an offering or not, the plague's going to stop. So I think this was an offering of thanksgiving. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was a difficult chapter, a tough way to end the two books of Samuel. Now we will go to the two books of Kings, starting with 1 Kings. We will take up chapter 1 in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.